publications. And I'm very pleased to have as my guest in the first segment of Education Matters today, Dr. Jack Peltz. And Dr. Peltz is an assistant professor at the University of Rochester, and I'll be asking him more about all the work that he is doing at the University of Rochester. And we are going to be talking about SST, and that is not supersonic transportation, but rather, what does SST stand for, Jack?
School start time.
School start time. And first of all, Jack, where did you grow up? Where did you go to elementary school, junior high, and high school?
Sure. So I actually grew up in Westchester County, New York, so outside of New York City,
mm-hmm.
And went to grade school in Tarrytown, New York, and then actually I went to a boarding school, so I was away from home for all high school, and in Connecticut, at a school called Taft, and that was my high school experience.
Okay. Out of curiosity, what was the average start time for you, let's say, when you were in high school?
Sure. It was definitely after 8 o'clock. Can't remember specifically it being any time after 8:30, but it's certainly because of the nature of the school. Sometimes you might have a free period first thing in the morning, but so it was similar to a college schedule. But at the same time, I think the earliest class was about 8 o'clock.
Okay. I'm looking at some data. It comes from the National Center for Educational Statistics, NCES, and this is 2011-2012 data. And it's a school and staffing survey, and it essentially talks about average start time for public high schools, and we're talking about public schools now. Mm-hmm. And across all of the United States, and these data are looking at 18,360 high schools across the United States, the average start time for public high schools across all of the United States is 7:59 a.m. Those high schools that start before 7:30 a.m., before 7:30, 9.5%. Those that start between 7:30 a.m. and 7:59 a.m., 33%. Those that start between 8 a.m. and 8:29 a.m., 43.1%. Those between 8:30 and 8:59, 10.6%, and 9 a.m. or later, 3.8%. So essentially, 77% are starting between 7:30 and 8:30, with the average start time being at 7:59. And just for our audience, for information purposes, here in the state of Wisconsin, I did some additional research. Here in the state of Wisconsin, the average start time in the state is 7:59 a.m. for high school, so we are right at the average. The study that you did, and I'm going to read the official title of your research study, and this appears in the Journal of the National Sleep Foundation. Sleep Health is the journal, and the title is A Process-Oriented Model Linking Adolescents, Sleep Hygiene, and Psychological Functioning, The Moderating Role of School Start Times. So give us, first of all, an overview with regards to why you and your colleagues who did this study, why you decided to actually do the study. What prompted it?
Sure. Well, first of all, I appreciate you reading out the title. It's quite a mouthful, and there's a lot to it. And so let me try and unpack some of it. So in the past couple decades, we certainly have become aware of the difficulties and challenges that adolescents face in terms of sleep, such that overwhelming majority of adolescents are either getting insufficient sleep or are getting poor quality sleep, and that ultimately has a real negative effect on their behavior, from not only their psychological functioning but also their academic performance, to even their, driving while drowsy and potential car crashes, so functioning in that regard. So we know that sleep is a real problem for adolescents and has real real-world outcomes, you know, real negative outcomes. So given that, we also know, and there's a, you know, certainly it's been emerging for a couple of decades, but certainly in the past few years, that school start times, which can change, you know, are variable, have an impact in terms of an environmental impact on adolescents' sleep. So what I mean by that is there are lots of things that affect an adolescent's sleep, from, you know, when they choose to go to bed to the process that, you know, they get ready for bed, whether or not they're on their iPhone before bed, watching movies before bed, how much homework they have at night. And with that said, in the morning, when they wake up, you know, that's largely determined by when they have school. So school is an important factor in terms of when they're waking up. Now, the study of school start times has typically looked at, does a change in the school start time predict a certain outcome in adolescence? So we call that sort of a direct effect model. Is there a direct relationship between the school start time and the outcome of interest? And that has been extremely important research, and, you know, many studies have shown that earlier school start times are associated with worse outcomes for adolescents. And in my work, which is a field of developmental psychopathology, so I'm really interested in looking at the intersection of normal and abnormal behavior. And part of that work is trying to understand what are some of the mechanisms or processes that affect adolescents, or, you know, children for that matter. And so I'm more concerned about what are the different processes, the different steps that lead to certain outcomes. And so in that regard, the when we call it a process-oriented model, is that we were trying to understand what are some of the things that are going to affect, in this case, adolescents' psychological functioning. So we know that there has been shown a direct effect between school start times and adolescents' psychological functioning, but what are some of the processes, you know, what are some of the things that are going to lead us to understanding, you know, what is, how their psychological functioning is affected. And so what we did with this particular study is we were interested in understanding what teenagers do in terms of the process of getting themselves ready for bed and preparing for a good night's sleep. Whether or not they're getting a good night's sleep, and ultimately how that is potentially impacting their psychological functioning. So that's sort of a model, you know, that we looked at. And then we looked at that model in the context of whether or not you're a student who wakes up or who goes to an early starting school, or basically anything before 8:30 a.m., or a school we call later starting schools, 8:30 a.m. or after. And that magic number, 8:30, is comes from the American Academy of Pediatricians, which a few years ago set a school start time, or as a policy initiative, that they should start at 8:30 to allow students to adolescent students to get a better night's sleep, longer night's sleep. And just the biological underpinnings of that are really that in adolescence, you know, when a student hits puberty, they shift in terms of their circadian rhythm. And so they actually want to go to bed later, want to wake up later, through no fault of their own, simply through biology. And that has, you know, sometimes we wonder, you know, why are teenagers sleeping so late? You know, why don't they get to bed earlier? Well, part of it is just simply biology. And unfortunately, the environment, or in this case, school start times, comes into direct conflict with their biology.
Mm-hmm.
So our interest in this study was understanding that, you know, this model of if a student can, adolescent age student can get themselves ready for bed in a good place before bed and get better quality sleep, and that's going to, you know, have what we think, you know, hypothesize a positive influence on their psychological functioning. Does that process differ for if you're, you know, waking up or an early starting time, early starting school or a later starting school? So that, in a nutshell, is sort of what led us to do what we did.
So after you analyze all of these data, give us a thumbnail sketch of your results and the findings that you came up with.
Yeah, so in terms of the data, I mean, what we were looking for is we measured specifically their sleep hygiene. So we looked at adolescents, filled out a lengthy questionnaire about how they prepared themselves to go to bed and whatnot. So that was one piece. And then what we did is we took, we also asked them about their, what we call circadian chronotype, which is basically their, whether or not they are more prone to be morning people or evening people. And so in addition to that, we also looked at, from the sleep diaries, we took their average in terms of how well they were sleeping across the week, how their average daily levels of depression and anxiety symptoms, as well as their average daily sleep duration. So if we think a little bit about, what is, where these things fell, well, what we found is that sleep quality was associated with their sleep hygiene. So for, in the most part, those who slept better had better sleep hygiene. Also, those who had better sleep hygiene, so who took more care and had a better routine going to bed, and who, we can talk more about sleep hygiene if you'd like, but certainly who had better sleep hygiene, those people tended to have, those students tended to have fewer depressive and anxiety symptoms. In terms of just simply the school start times, in our sample, for those of for those students who were who had a later school start time, that average was around 8:45 a.m. And those students who had a earlier school start, the average was around 7:45 a.m. So what we found is that the students who were getting had the later school start time were actually getting almost an hour more of sleep a day, which is considerable and really important in terms of thinking about the effects. So those were some of the effects. I mean, across the study, it was about split, even male and female. With that said, I think because of the nature of the sample, it was slightly more higher socioeconomic status. More Caucasian participants than we would see across the population.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at results from three other studies that looked at school start times. A study done by Finley Edwards at Colby College, the headline, if you will, in Education Next News, school start times found to affect student achievement. By changing the start time from 7:30 to 8:30 would increase standardized math and reading scores by 2 to 3 percentile points. And this was a study done in Wake County, North Carolina. Another study done by Andrew Kogan and Neil McGowan, ADHD, Attention Deficit and Hyperactivity Disorders, and talks about the effects of the circadian clock in ADHD and school start times. And then finally, and as a school board member, I mean, all these are important, and certainly your study as well. But this one, shifting school start times could contribute $83 billion to U.S. economy, and on an annual basis, $9.3 billion each year, which is roughly the annual revenue of Major League Baseball. And these economic gains projected through the study's model would be realized through the higher academic and professional performance of students and reduced car crashes among adolescents, as well as a change in transportation costs and school districts and bus routes, et cetera, et cetera. So my question for you, Jack, is with your study and all the other studies that have been done, and I looked at your CV, your resume, with all the research that you have done, here's the quintessential question I have for you as a researcher, as an educator, as a professor. Why is it that so many people always like to talk about all this wonderful research that's out there, and yet no one really listens to it and pays attention to it and says, hey, let's actually start changing the school start times, or let's start reducing classroom, the number of students in a class, because there's research out there that says that the number of students in a class when compared to large class sizes and small class sizes has an impact on achievement and the climate in the classroom. Why is it that people don't pay attention to the research?
First of all, that's a great question. Second of all, I wish I had the quintessential answer for you. I think there are a number of different factors. I think first is the, you know, you mentioned the economic, potential economic impact of, you know, what these researchers found in terms of school start times on, you know, society and whatnot. But at the same time, you know, the nature of our findings, I think there's a lot of inertia to that change, partially because of this belief that simply changing things, you know, when are we going to see these economic changes? And so there's sort of a disbelief there. I think also, especially with school start times, there's so many different hands in the pie, or simply different systems that are operating. So everyone, in terms of school start times, you have the schools and the coaches and after school activity coordinators. You have parents and teachers and teacher unions who have you know, concerns about when their employees or when their children, or as parents, you know, when they're going to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, you have bus drivers and, you know, school transportation and all of those aspects in terms of. So specifically for school start times, there is, I think it's so many people involved in making a decision, making this potential changes that it falls a little bit. There's an inertia. There's, you know, perhaps a tragedy of the commons, you know, who is sort of going to take charge. And ultimately, I think we fear, you know, changes to what we think has worked so well in the past. I mean, that's not to say, obviously, research has informed us as a society and certainly changed our behavior. In this case, I will say that in the past decade, the increasing research on school start times is having an effect, and certainly our increased attention on sleep is having an effect. So I can speak to upstate New York, and in the five or six school districts within a half-hour drive from my home, they are all of the superintendents are addressing this question. Now, when I say they're addressing this question, the first thing that they will say is, you know, all of these forces are keeping us from changing them, and they'll mention mm-hmm. economic forces, they'll mention buses, whatnot. You know, I wish that people, you know, would understand more about the research. You know, I'm really appreciative. I'm grateful of your work in terms of, you know, bringing light to this study, but also to other studies around this issue. And, you know, ultimately, I think that, you know, this work is going to, you know, I think slowly, you know, keep working its way into our consciousness. I think if we think of adolescence as our natural resource, you know, and the future citizens of you know, our country, that, you know, those that we have to, they are an incredible resource. If we don't take care of them, we are, you know, in a sense, wasting or losing out on that. So, you know, in terms of you know, why we don't pay attention or do enough with research, I think there's also a piece around, you know, a lot of the research done is correlational, and, you know, for every time that we have a study that, you know, has, you know, makes a neat headline, There will be people saying, well, these are just correlations. They're associations, and you know, we can only put so much stock in them, and you know, we can't. Obviously, we need more randomized controlled experiments to prove something. And the research in psychology is, you know, in any other science, sort of moves slowly, and we're very tentative in what we conclude because of simply that, you know, that's the nature of the scientific process. There's so many different factors, especially in a system, you know, like sleep, that could be operating that, you know, we would never be one to say, if you do this with school start times, this is exactly what you will get.
Sure. So, Jack, I want to thank you so much for being my guest this morning on Education Matters. And if our listeners want to read more about your study, how might they get access to either the study or the article that is online?
The best way to get access to this study and to other studies about school start times, the journal Sleep Health of the National Sleep Foundation actually had a special issue, of which our study is one of a number of studies about school start times. And so if they go to the Sleep Health Journal website and look at articles in print, there'll be my study with my co-authors, as well as about half a dozen other studies that specifically look at school start times. But that can all be found on the Sleep Health website.
And my guest in this first segment of Education Matters today has been Dr. Jack Peltz, who is a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center, and also assistant professor of psychological sciences at Damon College in Amherst, New York. And we continue now with Education Matters here on WGTDHD. And I'm very, very pleased to welcome as my guest in this segment, Mark Walsh. And Mark writes for Education Week, and his area of focus is school law. And Mark, welcome to Education Matters.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into some of the issues going on in Washington as far as with the U.S. Supreme Court and other legal issues, maybe if you could give our audience a sense of who Mark Walsh is, where you went to school, where you grew up, where you went to college, and how you got engaged and involved in the whole area of law as it pertains to education.
Well, I grew up in suburban Chicago. I'm, you know, Cubs fan, Bears fan, and I went to school at Northwestern University. I studied journalism and political science. I do not have a law degree. I'm in the Supreme Court press room among regulars who cover the Supreme Court. Maybe a quarter of them do have law degrees, but most do not. And, you know, it's a political beat as well as a legal beat, and we can usually, you know, get access to some very bright legal minds to explain some of those difficult things. But I was at Education Week full-time for many years and began covering the Supreme Court in 1991. The spring of that year is when Thurgood Marshall retired.
Yeah.
And when Clarence Thomas came on and obviously had quite a story with getting confirmed to the court. And with the exception of a few years where I was more of an editor, you know, I've been covering the court and education issues in the Supreme Court for all that time. I also covered the court a little more generally for a magazine called the ABA Journal, the American Bar Association's magazine. And again, I'm trying to explain for them, an audience of about 400,000 lawyers, some of the big issues. And and then contribute to a blog called SCOTUS Blog, which kind of covers the court up and down. And I usually am writing a column from the courtroom, especially in the spring when opinions are coming down, just because there are no cameras in the courtroom. And, you know, there may be well-known people in the courtroom or, you know, like a couple weeks ago we had Arnold Schwarzenegger in the courtroom for a case on redistricting, which is from Wisconsin, Switford.
And, yeah, that whole gerrymandering thing going on.
Yeah, partisan gerrymandering case. So, you know, so I'm looking for luminaries and sometimes some odd or ironic moments in the courtroom.
Why don't we drill down a little on a few topics in the time that we have? As everyone knows, here in the Kenosha area, there's the issue of transgender bathrooms and the case that's currently that will be heard by the court or on the transgender bathroom issue in Kenosha Unified. I know back in March, the headline of an article you wrote, education groups line up on different sides in transgender case. This was the Gloucester County School Board versus GG. Are you surprised at all that these cases are already at the U.S. Supreme Court level?
Well, not really, because I think it just evident, as it can be in any area of the law, that there's a lot going on in society on this issue and then in the lower courts. And so soon after the case from last term, which just to very quickly remind your audience, is the audience that the court had decided to grant review of a case involving transgender bathroom rights in school, but that case was sort of freighted with issues of administrative law that I certainly won't go too far into, but questions about guidance by the education department.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really why it was a surprise that the Supreme Court took up that case last term, or said that it was going to take that up, but I think the court was concerned about some major issues being decided based on some guidance letters from fairly mid-level bureaucrats at the U.S. Department of Education.
I'm looking at your September 29th of this year, your Educator's Guide to the Supreme Court's 2017-18 term, and you talk about union fees. And of course, here in Wisconsin, we have Act 10 that sort of essentially didn't totally do away with teachers' unions, but certainly it impacted the role and power of unions. But the second item, the little subheading is CAKE, Same-Sex Marriage, Religion, and Speech, and this is about the masterpiece Cake Shop and the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And when I first saw that, the first thing that you mentioned was exactly what I was wondering, and you state, the case has implications for education. And maybe if you could just talk briefly, why and how would this case that deals with a private owner of a cake shop, a bakery, have anything to do with education? And of course, this case is against the cake shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission.
Okay, so it's a very good question you ask, and it's a question I'm still asking myself,
mm-hmm.
partly because any big case in the Supreme Court, I'm sort of looking for the education angle, partly because that's my job, and I'm looking for things to write about, and I've found some pretty strange angles over the years. But here, this is where a private owner of a bakery who specializes in wedding cakes and specialty cakes refused to serve or bake a cake for a same-sex couple's marriage celebration for their reception. And under Colorado law, that couple went to that state body that deals with those kinds of civil rights issues and has won. But the Supreme Court's going to take up the case of the baker. So what are the education implications? Well, it's not completely clear to me yet, but other than the fact that, in society in general, we're often talking about religious objections mm-hmm. to civil rights laws, and that's to some degree maybe a little bit more of an issue at the college level. It's not so much an issue with public schools.
Although they do reference the Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett going back to 1943 with the Pledge of Allegiance. So maybe that's that seems to be the thread that does tie it into public education, right?
Right. So as I'm looking for these angles, the baker, Jack Phillips, in this case, and his lawyers, they do assert that being forced to bake a cake that would celebrate same-sex marriage when Mr. Phillips has, you know, religious objections to that, as one might expect would be the reason. That's a form of compelled speech, and then they're really they're most of their arguments are directed towards the First Amendment speech clause, the over the free exercise of religion clause, and Jack Phillips cites, you know, the 1943 case where the Supreme Court reversed itself from just a few years prior to that and said that the students in public school may not be compelled to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. That's the Barnett case.
As you look at other pending cases, maybe in the time that we have, which one or two cases do you see as the most prominent at this point that pertain to education?
Okay, so, you know, we've talked about a bunch of cases, and some of those are granted, and the Masterpiece Cake Shop, and you briefly mentioned the union fees case, and that was just granted right before the formal start of the term. That's where the court is going to return to this issue of whether people who don't want to join their public employee union but still have to pay a fee, a service fee, for being represented by that union. That's, you know, the court deadlocked on that, heard it right before Justice Scalia died, and now it's basically in the hands of new Justice Neil Gorsuch, it looks like, when that is argued probably in January. So those are among the cases that the court is hearing. Among those that, you know, that really could make this a bigger term for education, we mentioned the transgender case from Kenosha. We don't need to go further on that, but another one that I'm keeping a close eye on is one involving school board prayers, where the public school board opens its meeting with prayers. Just a few years ago, the court upheld prayers in by a municipal body, the town of Greece, New York, but the court did not, you know, make clear whether that would the same principles would apply at the school board level, and the lower courts have kind of grouped have kind of separated school boards apart from municipalities like county boards and city councils, or some have and some haven't, and so there really is kind of a split there. The question is, you know, school boards often have students around to be recognized, and the school board meetings are held in schools, and is it the same thing? So that's one, and that's you know, the court will decide at some point this fall probably whether to take up that case.
Yeah, and with that case, do you see as he has become sort of, people like to say, the conscience of the court. He sort of took Sandra Day O'Connor's place on the court now, the deciding voter on the court, and that's Justice Kennedy, the person who may very well be the deciding vote, or does that sort of fall into the category of one can never predict how a justice is going to vote?
I think this one would fall to Justice Kennedy, because I think based on other, you know, a variety of other things, including especially the town of Greece case, where he was at the center of that case, you know, I think that and then he wrote the opinion that said, you know, prayers can actually solemnize a public meeting, but he also has his concerns about compulsion on students, that is evidenced in his decision going back to the early 90s in the graduation prayer case known as Lee versus Weissman. So that, you know, I would love to see that one get granted. There's some talk here in Washington, and certainly there was last spring, but he did not retire. There's some talk that Justice Kennedy may retire at the end of this term, and that would be a big deal, obviously.
Yeah, and, you know, and with that, do you really think that, I mean, many people think, rather, that whether it be Justice Kennedy or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that maybe they're just holding out and in their minds hoping that there will be a Democratic president in 3 years or less, and maybe hold out and as long as their health holds out.
That's certainly sort of the conventional wisdom now, and I think it's certainly true with Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, and maybe even they could hope for, from their perspectives, for the Senate to change in just a little bit less than 2 years. And that might change the political dynamic, but justices tend to want to perhaps retire under the same administration under which they were appointed. But there are exceptions,
sure,
to that. I mean, both Justice Stevens and Justice Souter retired in the first couple years of the Obama administration.
Right.
And both were appointed by Republican presidents.
Right.
But they were also on the left side of the...
Sure. Court. Sure. And my last question for you, since you have been covering the court now since 1991, and now we have a new justice with Justice Gorsuch, I know there were a lot of analyses about how he might rule on issues on education, and there was a whole slew of cases, freedom of speech issues, First Amendment issues. Just based on your own analyses of cases that he has looked at, and I'm not asking you, to cite, specific cases, where do you see Justice Gorsuch now in terms of the influence that he might have on the court that maybe we didn't know about before?
So there was quite a bit there, because he had served about 10 years, I think, on the Tenth Circuit, so quite a bit there for people to chew on, and if you were interested in education cases, I was, to look at, and he had some generally conservative, generally for the school district, but you could say that about almost any judge, just in the things that come before them are just they tend to rule for the establishment to some degree. But they're one of his opinions where he just really did find the treatment of a student in a search case to be a bit appalling, and he was willing to write that, and then of course he got scrutinized heavily in his confirmation hearing over some of his special education rulings, including one in which the Supreme Court, in a different case, had really unanimously slapped down language that he had used in a case. So it's too early to say, of course, about how he's going to approach things in the Supreme Court until we get some education cases. But he has established himself, right away. He had one argument term last spring, and now one already this fall, where he is just intensely interested in the original meaning of a statute or of provision, and he's not afraid to write separately and give his opinion, and not afraid to, get into oral argument right away. So he's not shy.
So he's much more willing to actually speak when you compare him to how quiet Justice Thomas has been in the past.
Oh yeah, I mean he jumped into oral argument right away. There were some people said, new justices tend to sit back. I'm not sure that was ever true or not true in the modern era, but he has not always, necessarily been the first to get involved. He's sat back and waited till the end of some of the oral arguments I've seen, but he's as I say, not shy about getting involved, and he hasn't been shy about last spring writing some separate concurrences, sometimes on some very peculiar or small points. We're quite early in his time on the Supreme Court, so that they always evolve. some degree.
Mark Walsh, I want to thank you for taking your time, and I know you had just gotten back from, you know, being at the U.S. Supreme Court this morning, and hopefully we can have you back on Education Matters maybe sometime in the spring, and we can do an update on some of the cases, or certainly next June when they come up with the you know, the actual ruling that's on some of these cases.
Absolutely, I'd be glad to do it.
Okay, and as always, thank you for everything that you write and your contributions in the area of law.
Well, thanks, Steve. That's very kind, and I appreciate that. And always be willing to come back on and chat with you.
Okay, thanks so much. I'd like to thank my two guests this morning on Education Matters, Dr. Jack Peltz, who is assistant professor at Damon College in Amherst, New York. We talked about sleep health and start times for our public schools. And also Mark Walsh, who is a reporter who writes for Education Week and other publications, and we talked about some of the major issues right now in the area of school law. For Education Matters here on WGTD HD, I'm your host this week, Steve Brown, saying thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
This is WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College, and Jenny Tunkies, former reporter for the Kenosha News and a former chief of staff for the Kenosha County Executive. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
You are listening to WGTD HD 91.1. I'm your host, Jenny Tunkies, and this is Community Matters. This morning, my first guest is M.T. Boyle. M.T. is the Executive Director of the Burlington Area Chamber of Commerce, and she is new to that role, so we're going to talk about how she ended up in the executive director chair and find out all about the great things going on in Burlington. Welcome, MT.
Hi, Jenny. It's so great to be with you today. I'm so excited to be speaking with you. As you know, we're old friends.
Yes.
From our former roles with the county.
Right. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your path to becoming executive director of the chamber in Burlington.
Actually, it's so interesting that you asked that question because I was just introducing myself to the new board, and I was saying how my journey from my being an outside salesperson for selling children's books to area libraries, all the way to having a small business of my own right in downtown Burlington, where I sold storytime materials, and so I'm very familiar with the downtown Burlington area. And then, as you know, my husband is an elected official in Racine. And so through that, I ran his campaign and I kind of learned that aspect of my work life. I met a lot of people, including the current county executive, Jonathan Delgrave. I ran his campaign, then I worked closely with him at the county. And through that explosion of all sorts of extraordinary times between the Foxconn, whether you love that idea or not, it was actually the largest foreign investment on domestic oil, soil, and then there was the Burlington flood, which I was the PIO for. Anyway, so this whole experience of me really getting into the community through Racine County led me then to this place where I have to actually throw in there that 6 years ago, Jonathan asked me to be part of the Downtown Racine Corporation Board, which is another, you know, Main Street program, very community and business oriented. And I was there for 6 years, and the last two I was board president. So all of this led me to, when there was this posting at the Burlington Area Chamber was looking for a new executive director, it gave me pause, because even though I really enjoyed my work with the county, I thought, if I could bring all these experiences back, from me being a business owner, from me having this really deep community connections, serving on a lot of boards, especially a board that was going through a lot of what Burlington was going through, a rebranding process, revitalization, having to go through the pandemic. I just was really excited to have this opportunity. So I did apply. The board gave me their trust to lead the chamber now into this new era. Super excited to be living here right in Burlington.